PNC Bank brings you Call of the Wild Money Moves. You hear that?
YOLO!
That's an internet troll telling you to put all your money into a single investment.
YOLO! YOLO! YOLO!
He wants you to liquidate your emergency fund.
YOLO!
And buy a digital racehorse named Silicon Steve.
YOLO!
Stay vigilant. He's very persistent.
YOLO!
Guard against wild money moves with PNC Bank. Brilliantly boring since 1865.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Killing someone with the intent of selling their bodies to science for use at lectures? It was indeed once a business. A dark, shadowy business pioneered in the mid-1800s. Just how far did these killers go? And were they ever caught? Today, the Burke and Hare murders on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The Burke and Hare murders were a series of 16 killings committed over a period of about 10 months in 1828 in Edinburgh, Scotland. They were undertaken by William Burke and William Hare, who sold the corpses to Robert Knox for dissection at his anatomy lectures. Edinburgh was the leading European center of anatomical study in the early 19th century, in a time when the demand for cadavers led to a shortfall in legal supply. Scottish law required the corpses used for medical research should only come from those who had died in prison, suicide victims, or from foundlings and orphans. The shortage of corpses led to an increase in body snatching by what were known as resurrection men. Measures to ensure graves were left undisturbed, such as the use of all sorts of devices, mort safes. When a lodger in Hare's house died, Hare turned to his friend Burke for advice, and they decided to sell the body to Knox. They received what was for them a generous sum. A little over 2 months later, when Hare was concerned that a lodger suffering from fever would deter others from staying in the house, he and Burke murdered her and sold the body to Knox. The men continued their murder spree, probably with the knowledge of their wives. Burke and Hare's actions were uncovered after other lodgers discovered their last victim, Margaret Dorchty, and contacted the police. A forensic examination of Dorchty's body indicated she had probably been suffocated, but this could not be proven. Although the police suspected Burke and Hare of the other murders, there was no evidence on which they could take action. An offer was put to Hare, granting immunity from prosecution if he turned King's evidence, provided the details of Dorchty's murder, and confessed all 16 deaths. Formal charges were made against Burke and his wife for the three murders. At the subsequent trial, Burke was found guilty of one murder and sentenced to death. The case against his wife was found not proven. The Scottish legal verdict to acquit an individual but not declare them innocent. Burke was hanged shortly afterwards. His corpse was dissected and his skeleton displayed at the Anatomical Museum of Edinburgh Medical School, where, as at 2020, it remains. The murders raised public awareness of the need for bodies for medical research and contributed to the passing of the Anatomy Act of 1832. The events have made appearances in literature and have been portrayed in screen, either in heavily fictionalized accounts or as the inspirational work for fiction. So there you go. That would be like a nice little cottage you think you're getting there in Edinburgh. And you're like, all right, this would be great. Good fireplace. There's no Wi-Fi because that's not going to be coming out for another 100 and some years. But for now, you know, it'll have good Wi-Fi someday. Right now, I just like the fireplace. And suddenly you find the person next to you has just been killed for science. In the name of science. That's it. The dark side of Wikipedia. Tony and Carol Hughes joining you today. It's a creepy story.
That is so creepy.
I'm almost picturing like Headless Horseman, like Sleepy Hollow type worlds. And, you know, and somebody stopping at this cabin and staying there. And then, yeah, this is what happens.
1832. Like, I didn't even know about that. How's that in history and I've never even heard about it?
Well, they took it out of the second grade textbooks a few years ago because they thought it was a little too much.
For people like me who just read at the second grade level.
No, I'm just saying they used to teach it in second grade, but now they decided it was a bit much. But no, I don't recall this at all in history either. I don't know if it was just too dark or too whatnot, but it certainly is an interesting one. And, you know, there's a... It's interesting because I get it. You know, you're at the beginning of, you know, a lot of looking at the human body and such in the world of, you know, what was modern science of the day. But, you know, when you got a shortage of bodies, what do? I guess you turn to people like Burke and Hare. You know, get yourself somebody who's passing through town.
That is creepy stuff.
It would be so easy to get away with murder back then. You almost like kind of look at this going, how do you get... You got to really kind of screw something up to get caught. Because, I mean, today it's like forensic evidence and everything. It's like, there's no fucking way you can get away with it. So it's like, just don't even try. Not that you'd want to kill somebody, but it's like, there's just so many ways that like you can trace things. It's amazing and wonderful. But back then it's like, did someone see you do it? No. Okay. Then you must not have done it. Or we can't prove it. So we're done with this. You know, although there was also the extreme assumption crowd that would do their things, too, where it's like, they're a witch, you know, and then just kill them, too. So I guess right. I can't say completely it was a you can get away with anything. You could get away with anything, but you could also be accused of anything, too, and everyone will believe it's true. It's kind of similar to today in many ways.
Not that big of a stretch.
Let's continue on with the story and learn more about just how this grand old scheme of the original Best Buy started. By the 1820s, the residents of Edinburgh had taken to the streets to protest the increase in grave robbing. To avoid corpses being disinterred, bereaved families used several techniques in order to deter the thieves. Guards were hired to watch the graves. Watchtowers were built in several cemeteries. Some families hired a large stone slab that could be placed over a grave for a short period until the body had begun to decay past the point of being useful for an anatomist. Other families used a mort safe, an iron cage that surrounded the coffin. The high levels of vigilance from the public and the techniques used to deter the grave robbers led to what historian Ruth Richardson described as a growing atmosphere of crisis among anatomists because of the shortage of corpses. The historian Tim Marshall considers the situation meant Burke and Hare took grave robbing to its logical conclusion. Instead of digging up the dead, they accepted lucrative incentives to destroy the living. Knox was an anatomist who had qualified as a doctor in 1814. After contracting smallpox as a child, he was blind in one eye and badly disfigured. He undertook service as an army physician in the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, followed by a posting in England, and then during the Cape Frontier War in 1819 in southern Africa. He eventually settled in his hometown of Edinburgh in 1820. In 1825, he became a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons in Edinburgh, where he lectured on anatomy. He undertook dissections twice a day, and his advertising promised a full demonstration on flesh, anatomical subjects. As part of every course of lectures he delivered, he stated that his lessons drew over 400 pupils. Claire Taylor, his biographer in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, observes that he built up a formidable reputation as a teacher and lecturer and almost single-handedly raised the profile of the study of anatomy in Britain. Another biographer, Isabel Ray, considers that without Knox, the study of anatomy in Britain might not have progressed as it did. William Burke was born in 1872 in Erne County, Tyrone, Ireland, one of two sons to middle-class parents. Burke, along with his brother Constantine, had a comfortable upbringing and both joined the British Army as teenagers. Burke served in the Donegal Militia until he met and married a woman from County Mayo, where they later settled. The marriage was short-lived in 1818 after an argument with his father-in-law over land ownership. Burke deserted his wife and family. He moved to Scotland and became a laborer working on the Union Canal. He settled in the small village of Maddiston near Falkirk and set up home with Helen McDougall, with whom he affectionately nicknamed Nellie. She became his second wife. After a few years and when the work on the canals were finished, the couple moved to Tanner's Close, Edinburgh, in November of 1827. They became hawkers, selling secondhand clothes to impoverished locals. Burke then became a cobbler, a trade in which he experienced some success, earning upwards of a good living each week. He became known locally as an industrious and good-humored man who often entertained his clients by singing and dancing to them on their doorsteps while applying his trade. Although raised as a Roman Catholic, Burke became a regular worshiper at a Presbyterian religious meeting held in the Grass Market. He was seldom seen without a Bible. William Hare was probably born in County Armagh, County Londonderry, or in Newry. His age and year of birth are unknown. When he was arrested in 1828, he gave his age as 21, but one source states that he was born between 1792 and 1804. Information on his earlier life is scant, although it is possible that he worked in Ireland as an agricultural laborer before traveling to Britain. He worked on the Union Canal for several years before moving to Edinburgh in the mid-1820s, where he worked as a coal man's assistant. He lodged at Tanner's Close in the house of a man named Logue and his wife Margaret Laird in the nearby Westport area of the town. When Logue died in 1826, Hare may have married Margaret. Based on contemporary accounts, Brian Bailey, in his History of the Murders, describes Hare as illiterate and uncouth, a lean, quarrelsome, violent, and amoral character with the scars from old wounds about his head and brow. Bailey describes Margaret, who was also an Irish immigrant, as a hard-featured and debauched virago. In 1827, Burke and McDougall went to Penacook in Midlothian to work on the harvest, where they met Hare. The men became friends when Burke and McDougall returned to Edinburgh. They moved into Hare's Tanner's Close lodging house, where the two couples soon acquired a reputation for hard drinking and boisterous behavior. On the 29th of November, 1827, Donald, a lodger in Hare's house, died of dropsy shortly before receiving a quarterly army pension while owing some money in back rent. After Hare bemoaned his financial loss to Burke, the pair decided to sell Donald's body to one of the local anatomists. A carpenter provided a coffin for a burial, which was to be paid for by the local parish. After he left, the pair opened the coffin, removed the body, which they hid under the bed, filled the coffin with bark from local tanners, and released it. After dark on the way, the coffin was removed for burial. They took the corpse to Edinburgh University, where they looked for a purchaser. According to Burke's later testimony, they asked for directions to Professor Monroe, but a student sent them to Knox's premises in Surgeon Square. Although the man dealt with juniors when discussing the possibility of selling the body, it was Knox who arrived to fix the price. Hare received his money while Burke took another portion of the balance. Hare's larger share was to cover his loss from Donald's unpaid rent. According to Burke's official confession, as he and Hare left the university, one of Knox's assistants told them that the anatomist would be glad to see them again when they had another to dispose of. There's no agreement as to the order in which the murders took place, though. Burke made two confessions but gave different sequences for murders in each statement. The first was an official one given on the 3rd of January, 1829 to the sheriff's substitute, the prosecutor, and the fiscal to the assistant sheriff clerk. The second was in the form of an interview with the Edinburgh Courant, that was published on the 7th of February, 1829. These in turn differed from the order given in Hare's statement. Although the pair were agreed on many of the points of the murders, contemporary reports also differ from the confessions of the two men. More recent sources, including the accounts written by Brian Bailey, Lisa Rosner, and Owen Dudley Edwards, either follow one of the historic versions or present their own order of events. Most of the sources agree that the first murder was in January or February of 1828. It was either that of a miller named Joseph, lodging in Hare's house, or Abigail Simpson, a salt seller. The historian Lisa Rosner considers Joseph the more likely. A pillow was used to smother the victim, while later ones were suffocated by hand over the nose and mouth. The novelist Sir Walter Scott, who took a keen interest in the case, also thought the miller was the more likely first victim and highlighted that there was an additional motive to reconcile them to the deed, as Joseph was suffering from a fever and had become delirious. Hare and his wife were concerned that having a potentially infectious lodger would be bad for business. Hare again turned to Burke, and after providing their victim with whiskey, he suffocated Joseph while Burke lay across the upper torso to restrict movements. They again took the corpse to Knox and were paid. Rosner considered the method of murder to be ingenious. Burke's weight on the victim stifled movement and thus the ability to make noise, while it also prevented the chest from expanding should any air get past Hare's suffocating grip. In Rosner's opinion, the method would have been practically undetectable until the era of modern forensics. The order of the two victims next after Joseph is also unclear. Rosner puts the sequence as Abigail Simpson, followed by an English male lodger from Cheshire, while Bailey and Dudley Edwards each have the order as the English male lodger, followed by Simpson. Unnamed Englishman was a traveling seller of matches and tinder who fell ill with jaundice at Hare's lodging house. As with Joseph, Hare was concerned with the effect this illness might have on his business, and he and Burke employed the same modus operandi they had with Miller, Hare suffocating their victim while Burke lay over the body to stop movement and noise. Simpson was a pensioner who lived in the nearby village of Gilmerton and visited Edinburgh to supplement his pension by selling salt. On the 12th of February, 1828, the exact date Burke quoted in his confession, she was interviewed in the Hare's house and also plied with enough alcohol to ensure she was too drunk to return home. After murdering her, Burke and Hare placed the body in a tea chest and sold it to Knox. They received a hefty sum for each body. In Burke's confession records of Simpson's body, that Dr. Knox approved of it being so fresh, but did not ask any questions. In either February or March that year, an old woman was invited into the house by Margaret Hare. She gave her enough whiskey to fall asleep, and when Hare returned that afternoon, he covered the sleeping woman's mouth and nose with the bed tick, a stiff mattress cover, and left her. She was dead by nightfall, and Burke joined his companion to transport the corpse to Knox, who paid another hefty sum. But wait, there is more, and we'll get to that in just a moment. There's more murder to happen here in the Burke and Hare house. But thoughts thus far on this interesting case out of the 1830s?
Well, it's so interesting in so many ways. And the guy just keeps buying the corpses.
Yeah.
Like, no questions asked.
I don't care where you get them.
You had another person you know die. Darn. Here's some money. You know, it's like there's this total incentive there for them to keep doing it. He knew what they were doing. He had to have known what they were doing. But he didn't care because they're keeping up with demand.
He's getting the bodies. There wasn't exactly any anybody looking over the departments of or any sort of department of health or anything overlooking the medical community at that moment going, where are you sourcing these bodies from? As there would be today.
And you think now is even with DNA and everything, all the tools that they have to solve crimes and find people, there's still those, so many go under the radar. Like, I don't know what the percentage is, but there's a lot of unsolved cases.
Sure.
So then you consider way back 200 years ago.
Yeah.
It's a really long time ago. And there's nobody looking for the people either. It's a boarding house. It's not like these people had bunch of money in this great home life.
No.
He ended up there for a reason.
It was almost just looked, I mean, I don't know, I mean, if life was looked at as more disposable, or it was more, people were just more in tune with death because it would happen so much more frequently than it does in modern times. I don't want to say today, but I want to say in modern times, or had been in modern times. Mortality rates were certainly not what they are today or were. And I think maybe it's just, there was just that much more adoption of, well, you know, they died, let's move on, than there was today, where there's a lot of, you know, really getting into every single thing to make sure that there's no foul play involved. There's nobody horrible doing horrible things like this. Much easier just to brush off, it seems.
And when you have a motivator like money.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and at a point, like, he didn't probably even see him as people anymore.
No.
It was just somebody he can make some money off of.
Well, and you know, you're probably convincing yourself that you're doing them a favor, too, because they're ill. Well, some of them were ill anyway. And then at some point, it's like the money just outweighs all the reasoning, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So could it happen today? I mean, there is the, and I don't know a whole lot about it, but there is the underground or the dark organ trade, I know, that exists for transplants and such that goes beyond what, you know, insurance would cover or get their hands on. And so does some of that, I mean, kind of does that happen kind of in other countries or other, you know, places that aren't so well regulated or such?
I don't know, because I've heard about that happening, but then is it real or is that one of those urban myth things?
I don't know.
There's got to be some spark of truth in it, because that's usually how things like that get started.
I'd be curious. I mean, I'm not here to profess that I know anything about it other than I've heard about it over the years. And that's the extent of my knowledge. So how legit is it? To me, it seemed like it was, but again, I have no knowledge on it, so I'm not about to go send my family 50 emails saying, oh my God, look out, someone might break in your house tonight and steal your organs. But I know some people in my family who probably would do that after hearing just, you know, random information said on a podcast or an email or something like that. but that's a good one for Snopes to look up, because I'm kind of curious about that, to see what that is. I was unaware, I mean, quite honestly, of how horrible the world of human trafficking is until the last handful of years, since that's been really brought out into the attention of the world, of just how scarily prevalent it is and how it kind of goes on right underneath our eyes. And I didn't have any idea.
Again, it's that a lot of those people who are estranged from their own families.
Yeah.
So a lot of those people don't really have, you know, they might have connection to their family, but they don't talk to them daily. So it could be a month before they talk to them and nobody would think anything about it.
Yeah. Especially, you know, back in those days, you could go months, you go years sometimes.
Yeah.
If you're a traveling salesperson or something, like, I'll be back next November. You know, I hope you're still alive and the local coyotes haven't eaten our baby. You know, that would be life. But, you know, let's continue on with the story and hear more about who else happened to stop at the Holiday Inn. Burke met two women in early April, Mary Patterson, also known as Mary Mitchell, and Janet Brown, in another area of Edinburgh. He bought the two women alcohol before inviting them back to his lodging for breakfast. The three left the tavern with two bottles of whiskey and went instead to his brother's house. After his brother left for work, Burke and the women finished the whiskey, and Patterson fell asleep on the table. Burke and Brown continued talking, but were interrupted by McDougal, who accused them of having an affair. A row broke out between Burke and McDougal, during which he threw a glass at her, cutting her over the eye. Brown stated that she did not know Burke was married and left. McDougal also left and went to fetch Hare and his wife. They arrived shortly afterwards, and the two men locked their wives out of the room, then murdered Patterson and her sleep. That afternoon, the pair took the body to Knox in a tea chest. While McDougal kept Patterson's skirt and petticoats, they were paid more money for the corpse, which was still warm when they delivered it. Ferguson, one of Knox's assistants, asked where they had obtained the body, as he thought he recognized her. Burke explained that the girl had drunk herself to death and they had purchased it from an old woman in the area. Knox was delighted with the corpse and stored it in whiskey for 3 months before dissecting it. When Brown later searched for her friend, she was told that she had left for Glasgow with a traveling salesman. At some point in the early to mid-1828, Mrs. Haldane, whom Burke described as a stout old woman, lodged at Hare's premises. After she became drunk, she fell asleep in the stable. She was smothered and sold to Knox. Several months later, Haldane's daughter, either called Margaret or Peggy, also lodged at Hare's house. She and Burke drank together heavily, and he killed her without Hare's assistance. Her body was put in a tea chest and taken to Knox, where Burke was paid. The next murder occurred in May of 1828, when an old woman joined the house as a lodger. One evening, while she was intoxicated, Burke smothered her. Hare was not present in that house at the time. Her body was sold to Knox. Then came the murders of Effie, sometimes spelled E-F-F-I-E, a cinder gatherer who scavenged through bins and rubbish tips to sell her findings. Effie was known to Burke and had previously sold him scraps of leather for his cobbling business. Burke tempted her into the stable with whiskey, and when she was drunk enough, he and Hare killed her. Knox gave more money for the body. Another victim was found by Burke too drunk to stand. She was being helped by a local constable back to her lodgings when Burke offered to take her there himself. The policeman obliged, and Burke took her back to Hare's house, where she was killed. Her corpse raised more money from Knox. Burke and Hare murdered two lodgers in June, an old woman and a dumb boy, her grandson, as Burke later recalled in his confession. While the boy sat by the fire in the kitchen, his grandmother was murdered in the bedroom by the usual method. Burke and Hare then picked up the boy, carried him to the same room, where he was also killed. Burke later said that this was the murder that disturbed him the most, as he was haunted by his recollection of the boy's expression. The tea chest that was usually used by the couple to transport the bodies was found to be too small, so the bodies were forced into a herring barrel and taken to Surgeon Square, where they fetched more money for each body. According to Burke's confession, the barrel was loaded onto the cart with Hare's horse, refused to pull further than the grass market. Hare called a porter with a hand cart to help him transport the container. Once back in Tanner's close, Hare took his anger out on the horse by shooting it dead in the yard. On the 24th of June, Burke and McDougal departed for Falkirk to visit the latter's father. Burke knew that Hare was short of cash and had even pawned some of his clothes. When the couple returned, they found that Hare was wearing new clothes and had a surplus of money. After he was asked, Hare denied that he had sold another body. Burke checked with Knox, who confirmed Hare had sold a woman's body. It led to an argument between the two men. They came to blows. Burke and his wife moved into the home of his cousin, John Borgman, two streets away from Tanner's Close. The breach between the two men did not last long, though. In late September or early October, Hare was visiting Burke when Mrs. Ostler, also known as Holster, a washerwoman, came to the property to do the laundry. The men got her drunk and killed her. The corpse was with Knox that afternoon, for which the men were paid. A week or two later, one of McDougal's relatives, Ann Dougal, also given McDougal, was visiting from Falkirk. After a few days, the men killed her by their usual technique and received more money. Burke later claimed that about this time, Margaret Hare suggested killing Helen McDougal on the grounds that they could not trust her, as she was a Scotch woman, but he refused. Burke and Hare's next victim was a familiar figure in the streets of Edinburgh, James Wilson, an 18-year-old man with a limp caused by a deformed feet. He was mentally disabled, and according to Anna Knight, in her history of the murders, was inoffensive. He was known locally as Daft Jamie. He lived on the streets and supported himself by begging. In November, Hare lured Wilson to his lodging with a promise of whiskey and sent his wife to fetch Burke. The two murderers led Wilson into a bedroom, the door of which Margaret Hare locked before pushing the key back under the door. As Wilson did not like excess whiskey, he preferred snuff. He was not as drunk as most of the duo's victims. He was also strong and fought back against the two attackers, but was overpowered and killed in the normal way. His body was stripped and the few possessions he had stolen. Burke kept a snuff box and Hare a snuff spoon. When the body was examined the following day by Knox and his students, several of them recognized it to be Wilson. But Knox denied it could be anyone the students knew. When word started circulating that Wilson was missing, Knox dissected the body ahead of the others that were being held in storage. The head and feet were removed before the main dissection. The final victim, killed on the 31st of October, 1828, was Margaret Dorchty, a middle-aged Irish woman. Burke lured her into Borgin Lodging House by claiming that his mother was also a Dorchty from the same area of Ireland, and the pair began drinking. At one point, Burke left Dorchty in the company of Helen McDougall while he went out, obstinately to buy more whiskey, but actually to get hair. Two other lodgers, Anne and James Gray, were an inconvenience to the men, so they paid them to stay at Hare's lodging for the night, claiming Dorchty was a relative. The drinking continued into the evening, by which time Margaret Hare had joined in. At around 9 p.m., the Grays returned to briefly collect some clothing for their children and saw Burke, Hare, their wives, and Dorchty all drunk, singing and dancing. Although Burke and Hare came to blows at some point in the evening, they subsequently murdered Dorchty and put her body in a pile of straw at the end of the bed. The next day, the Grays returned, and Anne became suspicious when Burke would not let her approach a bed where she had left her stockings. When they were left alone in the house in the early evening, the Grays searched the straw and found Dorchty's body, showing blood and saliva on the face. On their way to alert the police, they ran into McDougall, who tried to bribe them with an offer of $10 a week. They refused. When the Grays reported the murder to the police, Burke and Hare removed the body and took it to Knox for surgery. The police searched and located Dorchty's bloodstained clothing hidden under the bed. Burke and his wife gave different times for Dorchty's departure from the house, which raised enough suspicion for the police to take them in for questioning. Early in the following morning, the police went to Knox's dissecting rooms where they found Dorchty's body. James Gray identified her as the woman he had seen with Burke and Hare. Hare and his wife were arrested that day, as was Borgin. All denied any knowledge of the events. In total, 16 people were murdered by Burke and Hare. Burke stated later that he and Hare were generally in the state of intoxication when the murders were carried out, and that he could not sleep at night without a bottle of whiskey by his bedside and a two-penny candle to burn all night beside him. When he awoke, he would take a drink from the bottle, sometimes half a bottle at a time, and that would make him sleep. He also took opium to ease his conscience. On the 3rd of November, 1828, a warrant was issued for the detention of Burke, Hare, and their wives. Borgin was released without further action. The four suspects were kept apart and statements taken. These conflicted with the initial answers given on the day of their arrest. After Dr. Alexander Black, a police surgeon, examined Dorchty's body, two forensic specialists were appointed, Robert Christensen and William Newbigging. They reported that it was probable the victim had been murdered by suffocation, but this could not be medically proven. On the basis of the report from the two doctors, the Burkes and Hares were charged with murder. As part of his investigation, Christensen interviewed Knox, who asserted that Burke and Hare had washed poor lodging houses in Edinburgh and purchased bodies before anyone claimed them for burial. Christensen thought Knox was deficient in principle and heart, but did not think he had broken the law. Although the police were sure the murder had taken place, and that at least one of the four was guilty, they were uncertain whether they could secure a conviction. Police also suspected that there had been other murders committed, but the lack of bodies hampered this line of inquiry. As news of the possibility of other murders came to the public's attention, newspapers began to publish lurid and inaccurate stories of the crimes. Speculative reports led members of the public to assume that all missing people had been victims. Janet Brown went to the police and identified her friend Mary Patterson's clothing, while a local baker informed them that Jamie Wilson's trousers were being worn by Constantine Burke's son. On the 19th of November, a warrant for the murder of Jamie Wilson was made against the four suspects. Sir William Ray, the Lord Advocate, followed a regular technique. He focused on one individual to extract a confession on which the others could be convicted. Hare was chosen, and on the 1st of December, he was offered immunity from prosecution if he turned King's evidence and provided the full details of the murder of Dorchty and any other because he could not be brought to testify against his wife. She was also exempt from prosecution. Hare made a full confession of all the deaths, and Ray decided sufficient evidence existed to secure a prosecution. On the 4th of December, formal charges were laid against Burke and McDougall for the murders of Mary Patterson, James Wilson, and Mrs. Dorchty. Knox faced no charges for the murders because Burke's statement to the police exonerated the surgeon. Public awareness of the news grew as newspapers and broadsides began releasing further details. Opinion was against the doctor, and according to Bailey, many in Edinburgh thought he was a sinister ringmaster who got Burke and Hare dancing to his tune. Several broadsides were published with editorials stating that he should have been in the dock alongside the murderers, which influenced public opinion. So again, it's a really, you know, just trying to make it in business story of somebody, you know, and these darn regulations getting in their way. Got to roll back those regulations of not being able to kill your customers at your inn and sell their bodies for science. It just slows down business.
And there's nothing that's going to help a criminal more than offering to pay them. You know, it's like, okay, I don't think you could entice someone that many times to continue murdering people for money unless they had to have at some point gotten some kind of sick thrill of it, or they just didn't care and it was 100% about the money.
I think it was
like,
go ahead.
Like what, that whole thing, like we pay for corpses. I can't even wrap my brain around that.
That'd be a great Halloween sign to put up. You know, like we sell firewood or fresh eggs. We buy corpses.
Yeah, you got to do it in that 5 cents. Like, you know, that kind of cutesy little farmhouse.
And like maybe a little like a little not an illustration, but like clip art, you know, type thing that's on there. Little piece of art. Coffin. I don't know what it would be, but.
Yeah, coffin, that would be good.
It'd be great. Put it at the end of the road right next to like fresh eggs.
Dead bodies.
We buy corpses. Yeah, that might bring some unwanted attention one's way should anyone ever attempt to do that. So don't do that at home, kids. There's just so much to unwrap in these stories, especially this one. It's like, and they stored the body in whiskey. Do you think they drank the whiskey after that? Or do you think it was like, you know, that one had a body in it?
I would hope. I would think they probably, after they took her out, they put somebody else in it.
Just keep reusing it, and maybe it's like a new blend. It turned out that's what Johnny Walker Red Label actually was, and still is today. There's if you do a forensic analysis of it, you end up finding that there's like little specimens of DNA in it, and because it just keeps going back to the same barrel that was used. I'm kidding. It's not true. Yeah, at least I hope it's
not. Like, yeah, I heard it.
It's real. It's a fact. I heard it on the radio. I heard it on a podcast, on a cast pod or something. That's how.
So as you're going, like, it's dead body, dead body, dead body, murder, murder, murder. So as you're telling that whole story, I'm like, that, you know, 200 years ago would be, how the hell do you figure out who they killed? How, like, the record keeping was so precise. So that's interesting how they got that guy to flip.
It is. It's amazing the amount of information that's in this and how detailed it is. I mean, there's some parts that they clearly state are they don't have the info on, but for being almost 200 years ago, you can almost, you know, put yourself, you know, in that time period when you hear this, because it's like, okay, there's crazy people. The interesting thing with it, though, is today it would be described as alcoholic drug addict. Killer friends arrested, you know, because they were on opium. They were always drunk when they were doing this. And the guy, and the one couldn't even like live with himself. So he was constantly drinking. And when he'd wake up in the night, get even more drunk because he couldn't. I mean, I don't think that these were your normal run-of-the-mill serial killers. I think it was very financially motivated. And then alcohol and drug induced, in not as an excuse or anything, but I think that had these people not had the access to alcohol or drugs, I don't know that they would have been able to do what they were doing.
Yeah, because a lot of people, when they get all shit-faced, their personalities are totally different.
Yeah.
So we've all known those people who, when they get really drunk, they turn into somebody you don't even know.
They try and kill you and sell your body to science.
Right.
We all had a friend like that once, you know. But no, it's scary and interesting to think of that this is, you know, this is the world one once lived in.
And but, you know, another thing I thought of as you're reading the story is that you don't really hear about that many serial murders from 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But then they I'm not saying that there wasn't any. You just didn't hear them because nobody could connect it.
I think it happened a lot, but there was no connections made and there was no investigations, and the information is just not there anymore to ever connect any of it. And like I was saying earlier, you could get away with a lot of horrible things back then and no one's ever going to catch you. It's sloppy work here that ends up sounding like that's what got them caught is, you know, well, you're wearing, you know, little Jimmy's overalls your son's wearing, who's dead. How did he get, you know, like, it's just a lot of things where it's like, had they been a little tighter with their body corpse business, who knows? It could have turned into, you know, the next Walmart.
Could be.
Could have been. What could have been? You know, you just trying to look like, try not to think about what might have been. Corpses were then. And we accidentally left one by the end of the bed. Little Texas. Little Texas, everybody. Little Texas. Okay.
You know, it's 200 years ago when the body is at the end of the bed in straw.
In straw. Yeah, exactly. In straw. There you go. Let's continue on with the story and get into the trial. The trial began at 10 a.m. on Christmas Eve of 1828 before the High Court of Judiciary in Edinburgh's Parliament House. The case was heard by the Lord Justice Clerk David Boyle, supported by the Lords Meadowbank, Pitt-Milly, and Mackenzie. The court was full shortly after the doors were opened at 9 a.m. and a large crowd gathered outside Parliament House. 300 constables were on duty to prevent disturbances, while infantry and cavalry were on standby as a further precaution. The case ran through the day and night into the following morning. Rosner notes that even a formal postponement of the case and dinner could have raised questions about the validity of the trial. When the charges were read out, the two defense counsels objected to McDougal and Burke being tried together. James Moncrief, Burke's defense lawyer, protested that his client was charged with three unconnected murders, committed each at a different time and at a different place, in a trial with another defendant who is not even alleged to have any concern with the two of the offenses of which he's accused. Several hours were spent on legal arguments about the objection. The judge decided that to ensure a fair trial, the indictment should be split into separate charges for the three murders. He gave Ray the choice as to which should be heard first. Ray opted for the murder of Dorchty, given that he had a corpse and had the strongest evidence. In the early afternoon, Burke and McDougal pled not guilty to the murder of Dorchty. The first witnesses were taken and called from a list of 55 that included Hare and Knox. Not all the witnesses on the list were called, and Knox, with three of his assistants, avoided being questioned in court. One of Knox's assistants, David Patterson, who had been the main person Burke and Hare had dealt with at Knox's surgery, was called and confirmed that the pair had supplied the doctor with several corpses. In the early evening, Hare took the stand to give evidence. Under cross-examination about the murder of Dorchty, Hare claimed Burke had been the sole murderer, and McDougal had twice been involved by bringing Dorchty back to the house after she had run out. Hare stated that he had assisted Burke in the delivery of the body to Knox. Although he was asked about the other murders, he was not obliged to answer the questions, as the charge related only to the death of Dorchty. After Hare's questioning, his wife entered the witness box carrying their baby daughter, who was suffering from whooping cough. Margaret used the child's coughing fits as a way to give herself thinking time for some of the questions, as told the court that she had a very poor memory and could not remember many of the events. The final prosecution witnesses were the two doctors, Black and Christensen. Both said they suspected foul play, but there was no forensic evidence to support the suggestion of murder. There were no witnesses called for the defense, although the pretrial declarations by Burke and McDougal were read out in their place. The prosecution summed up their case, after which at 3 a.m. Burke's defense lawyer began his final statement, which lasted for 2 hours. McDougal's defense lawyer began his address to the jury on his client's behalf at 5 a.m. Boyle then gave his summoning up, directing the jury to accept the arguments of the prosecution. The jury retired to consider its verdict at 8:30 a.m. on Christmas Day and returned 50 minutes later. It delivered a guilty verdict against Burke for the murder of Dorchty, the same charge against McDougal they found not proven. As he passed the death sentence against Burke, Boyle told him, "Your body should be publicly dissected, and I trust that if it is ever customary to preserve skeletons, yours will be preserved in order that posterity may keep in remembrance your crimes." McDougal was released at the end of the trial and returned home. The following day, she went to buy whiskey and was confronted by a mob who were angry at the not proven guilty verdict. She was taken to a police building in nearby Fountain Bridge for her own protection, but after the mob laid siege to it, she escaped through a back window of the main police station off Edinburgh High Street. She tried to see Burke, but permission was refused. She left Edinburgh the next day, and there are no clear accounts of her later life. On January 3rd of 1829, on the advice of both Catholic priests and Presbyterian clergy, Burke made another confession. This was more detailed than the official one provided prior to his trial. He placed much of the blame for the murders on Hare. On January 16th, 1829, a petition on behalf of James Wilson's mother and sister, protesting against Hare's immunity and intended release from prison, was given lengthy consideration by the High Court and judiciary and rejected by a vote of 4-2. Margaret Hare was released on 19th of January and traveled to Glasgow to find a passage back to Ireland. While waiting for a ship, she was recognized and attacked by a mob. She was given shelter in a police station before being given a police escort onto a Belfast-bound vessel. No clear accounts exist of what became of her after she landed in Ireland. Burke was hanged on the morning of the July 28th, 1829, in front of a crowd possibly as large as 25,000, with views from windows in their tenements overlooking the scaffolding, or hired at high prices ranging from 5 to 20 shillings. On the 1st of February, his corpse was publicly dissected by Professor Monroe on the Anatomy Theater of the University's Old College. Police had to be called when large numbers of students gathered, demanding access to the lecture, for which a limited number of tickets had been issued. A minor riot ensued. Calm was restored only after one of the university professors negotiated with the crowd that they would be allowed to pass through the theater in batches of 50 after the dissection. During the procedure, which lasted for 2 hours, Monroe dipped his quill pen into Burke's blood and wrote, "This is written with the blood of William Burke, who was hanged in Edinburgh. This blood was taken from his head." Burke's skeleton was given to the Anatomical Museum of the Edinburgh Medical School, where as of 2018 it remains. His death mask and a book said to be bound with his tanned skin can be seen at Surgeons Hall Museum. Hare was released on the 5th of February, 1829. His extended stay in custody had been undertaken for his own protection and was assisted in leaving Edinburgh in disguise by a militia. At one of the stops, he was recognized by a fellow passenger, Erskine Douglas Sanford, a junior counsel who had represented Wilson's family. Sanford informed his fellow passengers of Hare's identity. On arrival in Dumfries, the news of Hare's presence spread, and a large crowd gathered at a hostelry at an area where he was due to stay the night. Police arrived and arranged for the decoy coach to draw off the crowd, while Hare escaped through a back window and into a carriage, which took him into town's prison for safekeeping. A crowd surrounded the building, stones were thrown at the door, and windows and street lamps were smashed before 100 special constables arrived to restore order. In the small hours of the morning, escorted by a sheriff officer and militia guard, Hare was taken out of town, set down on the NN Road, and instructed to make his way to the English border. There were no subsequent relatable sightings of him, and his eventual fate was unknown. Knox refused to make any public statements about his dealings with Burke and Hare. The common thought in Edinburgh was that he was culpable in the events, but was lampooned in caricature, and in February, a crowd gathered outside his house and burned an effigy of him. A committee of inquiry cleared him of complicity and reported that they had seen no evidence that Dr. Knox or his assistants knew that murder was committed in procuring any of the subjects brought to his rooms. He resigned from his position as curator of the College of Surgeons Museum and was gradually excluded from university life by his peers. He left Edinburgh in 1842 and lectured in Britain and mainland Europe. While working in London, he fell foul of regulations of the Royal College of Surgeons and was debarred from lecturing. He was removed from the roles of Fellows of the Royal Society of Edinburgh in 1848. From 1856, he worked as a pathological anatomist at the Brompton Cancer Hospital and had a medical practice in Hackney until his death in 1862. Well, I'm amazed by the level of public outrage at this. I mean, today I could totally see it by the way that news spreads today. But back then, you weren't getting notifications on your watch every 10 minutes of what's going on with the guys that were, you know, killing people and selling corpses. So the public outcry against these people, very similar to things we see today in terms of, you know, seeking justice, if you will, for what one views as being a horrible, horrible crime, which of course they were. I guess I'm just surprised by the number of like 25,000 people showing up to watch him hang.
Well, you know, back in the day,
that was entertainment.
Way back,
yeah,
when they did public hangings, that was the thing. Like people would pack picnic lunches to go watch the hangings.
That's true.
You know, and so you figure 200 years ago. And then on top of that, it is so different than today because we have so much news coming at us all the time. Mm-hmm. So then you didn't. And probably people followed that story. You know, I'm sure there's people in the trial. As soon as it was over, they ran outside and yelled whatever it was. And
yeah,
he's guilty. And then there's just pandemonium.
Just spread.
You know, and outrage. But there are so many things in that to unpack. Like it's a very fascinating, sick story.
It is. Here's what I'm, I guess, most amazed by is the distance at which the news traveled. And I know you had newspapers and such, which news to travel. I'm not so surprised by the outrage in the respective town where these things happened in Edinburgh, but I am more surprised by the mobs gathering in cities and towns far away, where this wasn't like maybe necessarily, you know, affecting them personally. But, you know, these were traveling folks. So I'm wondering, you know, maybe there was some of this stuff where, you know, so-and-so was from over here or over there. And so everyone's following this news because it is, you know, it is the drama of the day. And it is such a dark, dark story. And it sounded like they knew pretty much all these details that we're talking about today back then as well. It'd be interesting to grab a newspaper from that time and read it and see exactly how it was all portrayed and how everything was reported on. But what a dark, dark, twisted story of two people just trying to make a buck.
We, you know, just got to make a little extra money. So yeah, Let's kill somebody so we can have some more liquor tonight or whatever.
I guess another part that that kind of shocked me is the part.
Drink a lot. I'm assuming that's where most of the money went.
I'm guessing so. It had to fund the addiction there. But the I guess one of the other parts I was kind of shocked by is that there was a book of his notes that was then wrapped in his own flesh. So,
right.
So someone at the university said, let's take this big old leg piece over here and let's wrap this book in it. I mean, that's kind of grisly in itself, where it's like, you're there to learn about anatomy to be a surgeon. You're not here to, you know, make the new bestseller out of, you know, this guy's back, you know, fat. It's just like, that one's a little grisly, but and it's still in a museum today. And I'm glad it's in a museum, probably behind glass or something, and you can't accidentally check that one out of the library, because that would be a little awkward.
Just weird. It's like, you know, I got an idea. Before we destroy the body completely, let's take that skin off and wrap this book in it.
It's kind of Ed Gein-ish, you know? It's a little, I don't know how that conversation would have went. Unless it was, everyone was just so out for revenge. I mean, they wrote in his blood. And I mean, it just sounds like full outrage. And they were trying to do everything they could to disgrace this corpse. And, you know, they did. I wonder if more shit was done to the corpse that wasn't reported and we're not aware of, considering the amount that was reported on of what they did with it.
Well, you know, in way back when they did hangings, like or when they would behead someone, mm-hmm. you know, the blood goes everywhere. They would take cloth and dip it in the blood as a souvenir. You know, like I would go to St. Peter's and I'd buy a rosary as a souvenir. They go there and it's like, hey, this is the blood of Anne Boleyn. And they could sell it or it's a keepsake.
Wow.
It's so strange.
Glad we don't see that shit in antique stores. That would be kind of, what's this cloth here with this dark stain on it? Oh, that's from a hanging that happened in, yeah. That's, yeah. Wow. I guess so many things in there that I was unaware of, I guess, how they practiced some things back then. Just all around kind of disturbed by it. But there you go.
But no TV. So to them, it was like, big day.
Yeah.
They are hanging the next, five guys today.
The next time you criticize reality television, if we didn't have it, this is the shit that we'd be doing.
So, oh God, you know it. It'd be even worse.
Although I today I feel like we're like two steps away from this being, you know, the next Fear Factor or something like this. So
why I cannot watch Handmaid's Tale. I watched one episode. I read the book years ago. I'm like, this just seems like something that could happen.
Yeah.
Watch it.
There's enough now that could happen and is happening. So that's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia, the Burke and Hare murders. If you like our show, please be sure to press subscribe, whatever platform it is you listen to us on. Let your friends know that we exist. Spread the reviews. Spread the love. Share us on social media. We greatly appreciate it. You can follow us on Instagram, Carol's at Carol Hughes. I am at Tony Bruschi, Tony, B-R-U-E-S-K-I. Until next time, for Carol and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Find the one and save big this summer during Haverty's July 4th sale. Right now, everything is on sale from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 21 plus.
Find the one and save big this summer during Haverty's July 4th sale. Right now, everything is on sale from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to chumbacasino.com.
Chumbacasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit chumbacasino.com.
By law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Find the one and save big this summer during Haverty's July 4th sale. Right now, everything is on sale from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Identity theft can cost more than you think. Drained investment accounts, stolen tax returns, lost wages, expenses for lawyers. It's a lot. That's why LifeLock is backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, which covers up to $1 million each for stolen funds, fees for experts and lawyers, and out-of-pocket expenses. Don't face the burden of identity theft alone. Protect your future and finances with LifeLock. Join now and save up to 30% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.